show. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Well, here we are, Thorn in the Side Thursday. This is The Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. Available for your listening pleasure on a wide variety of platforms all over the interweb tubes. Places like Dar.fm and Stitcher Radio. And TuneIn Radio and Streama.com, available on Roku devices, if you've got a device that is enabled for internet broadcast reception, we're there. Of course, the easiest way to get the Horn stream is simply to go to HeadOnRadioNetwork.com and click that Listen Live button, and bang, there you are. The podcast address for this program is to be found under the Head On with Bob Kincaid link at WhiteRoseSociety.org. You can also get the podcast at iTunes. We do not know why the Horn disappeared from iTunes Radio, but disappear it did. No idea. So it is in fact Thorn in the Side Thursday. Oh, hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. It's Thorn in the Side Thursday, and this gentle reminder before we get into the meat of the program: The Horn exists because of your determined, or because of your determination that it exists. That is to say, The Horn exists because you contribute to keep it going. We look to raise about $150 a night. We didn't do so last night. Didn't do so the night before. We didn't do so the night before that either. But we'll be okay. We just got some catching up to do. And with that in mind, I received communication earlier today from a Horn listener who wanted to put out a challenge from Shirley. There's $100 on the table, actually in the mail right now, that Shirley would like to see met by another 100. Which would help us catch up with what we're missing and move us a little toward actually getting level. So Shirley's $100 challenge is on the table for this evening. That's 10 folks at $10, 20 folks at $5, 50 at $2, 4 at $25. You know all the possible permutations and alternatives. And hopefully we will do that and perhaps more by the end of the program, because the only way that December happens on the Horn is if we meet our fundraising goal in November. We're a month-to-month kind of operation. I wish we were funded by wild-eyed, radical, liberal, wealthy people, but it's kind of a working people's radio network, and I guess it'll be working people who have to keep it going. Thorn in the Side Thursday stuff, you know, stuff that kind of makes us go, ew. Yeah, there's a few of those. You know, of course, the story of what happened in at the University of Mississippi on Tuesday night. White folks rioted at the University of Mississippi. They rioted when they found, when they realized that their dream of a return to a white man in their white house in Washington, D.C., was not going to come true. It was ugly. It was nasty. And the president of the university says, you know, there will be an investigation. What that comes to, who knows? Others are simply calling it a disturbance. This is, however, a tale of two universities. Not just the University of Mississippi. We've got some audio from Ole Miss. WMC-TV said it all started on social media, and 300 to 400 young people then gathered up. Obama campaign signs were burned. Maybe one of them was the one that got stolen out of my yard. Now, where did the idea for this come from? Well, the right wing, the white wing, had been predicting for some time that, well, if that Obama don't win, them black teenagers is going to riot on us. And it, right. It turns out the white kids are the ones who riot. Nice, huh? Yeah. But they're getting desperate. They really, really are. There's a series of photographs out there. I think there's a link to it in the chat room right now of sad white people in the aftermath of the ass whooping that Willard Romney took. Let's check out some of the gnat sound from Oxpatch, Mississippi. I haven't seen white people pissed off on a college campus that badly since Joe Paterno was fired. But like I said, it's a tale of two campuses, a tale of two universities. When you are bathed in white, when you're bathed in white privilege, like white folks at the University of Mississippi, I guess one can say that they're not prone to taking things well. They don't like that one in their White House. But this story has been a long time. This other half of the tale of two unis has been a long time in the coming. The story comes from the Socialist Worker. Now, I know you don't shrug your shoulders and say, sure. But the for-profit media probably do. God knows you're not going to see this showing up anytime soon over in the pages of the old gray lady. The story broke on October the 22nd. The sad thing is, the story itself happened as far back as April. And guess what? It didn't happen in Mississippi. It didn't happen in Alabama. It didn't happen in Texas. It didn't happen in Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, Tennessee, Arkansas, Oklahoma. It happened in Columbus, Ohio. A young Ohio State student by the name of Joseph Hines was beaten. And I don't mean they got a little rough with him. I mean, he was beaten. The adverb viciously is in play. It goes back, like I said, to April. In the last few months, the Ohio State University has been the scene of some pretty nasty, racially charged conduct. Back in April, early in April, April the 4th of this now fading year, an act of racial vandalism was perpetrated at the Frank W. Hale Jr. Black Cultural Center at Ohio State University. Spray painted on the walls there were the words, "Long live Zimmerman." You know what that means, right? Of course you do. It's a reference to George Zimmerman, the vigilante who decided to be judge, jury, and executioner of Trayvon Martin and convicted him summarily and executed him for the crime of carrying Skittles and iced tea. The spray painting, of course, on April the 4th also took place on the anniversary of the assassination of Dr. King. There was a mass response by the community of color at OSU. A committee was formed. A task force was formed. The committee wouldn't do. In the course of the task force's work, they discovered, anti-Asian Twitter accounts with about 1,600 followers. The climate is less than pleasant. And still, not much in the way of outrage or national attention. To the brutalization of Joseph Hines. He was, in short, pepper sprayed, hog tied, and beaten unconscious in what perhaps we might refer to as a little small scale police riot. So often it's the case that the riots are not perpetrated by Americans, but by the police who are tasked with keeping the public peace. Ugliness. Brutal ugliness. Several days later, a photograph was taken of Mr. Hines, in which one of his eyes was still swollen shut. There has been no explanation by the police to this day for why they felt the need to stomp, pepper spray, hog tie, and beat unconscious this young man. But in a way, it's a reminder that nothing ended. Nothing was settled by this recent election. Texas Betsy telling me that her son, who is now a college freshman, had a real culture shock seeing the racism and bigotry of his fellow Texans down at the University of Texas, San Antonio. And it is shocking to behold. Even here, within my own family. Ferg, for instance, being contacted by people saying, "Well, I sure hope you like it when Obama takes her guns away." I don't even have a gun. Good things did happen out of the election. But Lord God knows it's not all there is to talk about. Not by a long shot. It will be interesting to see what kind of federal response we get out of the cannabis referenda in Colorado and Washington. There is evidence to suggest, just go look on my Facebook page, Beth has posted a couple of beauties there, that the white wing really hasn't figured out that it has a rape problem. And they're going to keep on listening to the weirdo cultists of the right of the white wing religion industry, blathering on and on and on about the little fetuses. There is something approaching a coup taking place with apparently a whole lot of pissed off billionaires trying to figure out whether they want to bake, bean, boil, broil, braise, poach, just exactly how they want to take care of Karl Rove, who relieved them of some nearly $400 million and lost every race but one. I happened to be clicking around through the various and sundry cable news channels this afternoon before the program started. And they're still all talking about the election. And we'll talk about some of it, too. That's not to say it should not be discussed. But But there's ever so much more going on in the world. I even saw one story over on Chicken Noodle News talking about, Jesus Christ, really, the 2016 presidential election. Now, lest I appear to be a hypocrite, I have suggested it's time to start thinking about 2014 because the right wing never takes a day off, as Boss Man Wayne has said so many times. They never do. They never take a day off. They started working on 2016 probably on November the 5th, if not before. 2014, however, is something we need to be thinking about. Progressives especially. If you look over to the Horn Facebook page, Benedict posted something there that is worthy of consideration. The vote totals in Florida and what they mean from a third-party perspective. I highly recommend going and having a look. And if you have not liked, and it certainly would be nice if you did, if you have not liked the Horn's Facebook page, I recommend that you do so. It's The Horn. Just look for The Horn, THEH.O.R.N. head hyphen on radio network. Go like it. We need to expand the reach of that little old page. This would probably be an appropriate time to mention that you can follow me on Facebook at Bob Kincaid. You can also follow The Horn, like The Horn, on Facebook. And you can follow me on Twitter at Bob Kincaid, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D. Now, I should also tell you that here in a very few minutes, we're going to have a guest. We don't do a lot of guests around here, among other things, because I got frustrated with doing all the work that goes into having a guest and then having them not show up. By show up, I mean pick up the telephone and make the call. But we are having a guest this evening, a friend and colleague of mine, Paul Corbett Brown, an internationally renowned photographer, has just returned from Germany, where he was working with the same folks I worked with over there in the spring. And I think we'll have a lot to talk about in that vein, talk a little bit about a lot about mountaintop removal, how we bring this to an end, talk about what West Virginia feels like right now, because while gains were made in other states, this state went completely backwards. Because the top of the ticket, people like Blanche Manchin and Nick Ray Hall and Earl Ray Tomlin, couldn't bear to even breathe the name Barack Obama, a lot of folks down ballot got punished by teabaggers as a result, because unity is the name of the game. We'll have a little mountaintop removal talk here in a very few minutes. Just checking out the phones to make sure everything's still okay. A little story out of... back to the email. Dr. John writing in, he says, whatever happened to university kids? Unrest? Riots in favor of the status quo? Race privilege? Money and capitalism? The hell? Didn't university kids used to hold protests against money, power, and militarism? The Vietnam protests, SNCC, Kent State? Yeah, I mean, we even had some on-campus radicalism when, you know, a million years ago when I rode to class at Harvard on the Mon on the back of my dinosaur. Not a lot, but some. Dr. John says, my generation is heir to the idea of young people speaking truth to power. But we seem to have lost it. I see it in my courses. I mention race, class, capitalism, even in passing, even in context. And I see eyes glaze over, shoulders slump, kids check their watches or their phones. Maybe it's a class difference? Are students today more elite than students a generation ago? I think an argument can be made for that. The privatization of the student loan racket was in part designed to keep people out of school, not put them in it. You know, those people. The assault on affirmative action mounted by the right wing was to get the university community back to the white way of doing things. Because Dr. John asks, are they more white? I find that hard to believe. I think it's true, Dr. John. Perhaps it's the bootstrap post-racial rugged individualism ideology that's been bombarding them their whole lives. God, how effective has the right wing been? John asks. And the answer? Quite. A few weeks ago, at John's mention, we went over that list of what the entering freshman class's world is to them. Consider that this fall's entering freshman was born in when? 1994. So they've been bathed, and this goes back to something I mentioned a night or so ago. They've been bathed in globalism. There is no alternative. Vietnam is something that happened to their grandfathers. So-called women's liberation is something that their grandmothers talk about once in a while, maybe, depending on where it is in the country that they are. There's a lot of privilege out there, and a lot of suppressed memory. It's a lot of suppressed history. Indeed. So that's, you know, a start. The thorn in the side Thursday. And I'm just sort of waiting now for Paul Corbett Brown to call in. I think you'll like him a lot. What else is out there this evening? Karl Rove saying that Barack Obama suppressed the vote. Yeah, don't everybody laugh at once. Your thoughts on... have you seen the videos coming out of Greece? That's one of the things that frustrates me most about these cable news networks that can't seem to cover anything but the election. The people like to talk constantly about how this is professional journalism and how the market, and this is all based at, for instance, CNN went running off to the right because they were trying to keep up with Fox News. Is there no... And people walking out of polls responded that foreign policy... Only 5% said foreign policy was their number one issue. That says something. Is there no niche in this country for foreign policy and foreign affairs news. If you're watching the for-profit media, you can be pretty sure that there's not. I am hoping this is our buddy Paul Corbett Brown. Is that you, Paul?
No, it's Ben Birch.
Hey, Ben, what's up?
Well, just a fun little tidbit. I usually can't call in because I'm usually working late, but I'm out tonight. Did you hear what happened to the Romney staffers yesterday morning?
The staffers?
The staffers.
No,
they
what?
They got screwed, Bob. It turns out that when the Romney staffers left their posts after all the crying was done and got in cabs and took the cabs back to their hotels, they found out that their Romney credit cards had already been shut off.
Oh, my goodness. So they were literally out in the cold?
They were literally out in the cold, having to pay their own way and having to pay their own hotel bills. They were apparently all shut off the minute that it was determined Romney wasn't going to win.
Well, you know, he didn't get to be a multimillionaire by throwing money around like manhole covers.
But I'm thinking, you know, if he ever runs for anything again, which I'm hoping he doesn't, this is going to come back to bite him, and it may bite the next Republican too when they try to get people to work for them, because folks are going to remember this one.
Well, and a lot of those, you know, a lot of those folks, those so-called staffers, Ben, are not wealthy people. They're principled, and many of them are young, working
right.
For peanuts.
Yep.
So when you get stiffed out of your hotel room, you know, where do you come up with the $300 to pay for your last night there?
Exactly. This was Boston. You know, this is not cheap stuff here. This isn't the motel thing, you know, in exactly.
No, this is not. We'll keep the lights on for you.
Yep.
Well, that is very interesting and not at all surprising. I guess being Mormons and everything, I guess they were afraid their little heathen staffers might go on drinking binges and you know, room service up some Cristal or some such.
Coca-Cola.
Or Coca-Cola, for that matter, exactly. Well, that is interesting indeed. Ben, I've got an interview coming here. But something I've said to you in the past, can we make time at some point very, very soon to talk about the history of the White Rose Society as you founded it and as it has gone on for these 10 years?
I sure will.
I would really appreciate it because people need to know the heroic labors that have gone into that.
Yeah, it's not been as heroic as you might think, but I appreciate it.
Well, it's been plenty heroic in my book. Ben, have a wonderful evening.
Thank you very much. Bye.
Bye now. So, the Romney staffers got stiffed. Not surprising. Wouldn't you hate to be the waiter at the? Wouldn't you hate to be the server at the table the Romneys were at? Here's your tip: buy low and sell high. Sheesh. Is that you, Paul?
Indeed.
Hey, Paul Corbett Brown. Thank you very much for calling in. I appreciate it, my friend, my colleague. My fellow Fayette Countian, world-renowned photographer, and recent returnee from Germany in yet another attempt to get the banks over there to see reason if we can't get them over here to see reason. What were your initial thoughts, your initial impressions?
Well, I think that the banks are slowly waking up to the fact that they are financing the murder of people. And I think that they are slowly but surely waking up to realize that they do have some responsibility to society and to the people, not just to their stockholders, but also to the people who are stakeholders in the rest of the world. And that's what my initial impression is. I really do think that there are certainly bankers who are starting to wake up and realize that this cannot go on the way it is.
Now, when I was over there, we got to speak to the annual general meeting, which is like the giant shareholders thingy, and we got about 30 seconds apiece, and it was really kind of sad. But you actually sat down with a bunch of banks at one time, right?
Right.
Who was there?
Well, there were banks represented from, major banks represented from all over Germany, Austria, and Switzerland. I'm not familiar with all the banking that goes on in Europe, but certainly it seemed to be a who's who of banking in Europe.
So you were it was actually a sit down meeting with representatives from these several banks?
Right. There were probably close to 24 representatives from various banks, and then about the same number of other folks who had other interests in there, mostly NGOs and stuff that wanted to share where they were at with things.
Yeah, things like nuclear and landmines and. Yeah.
This whole meeting was mostly about just banking, actually.
Oh.
I mean, about mining. And
oh, okay. Wonderful.
Yeah, it was mostly about mining, not all of it coal, but I would say that certainly the lion's share of this meeting was about coal mining, and in particular mountaintop mining.
So as you sat down there, how long did you have to speak to them, Paul?
About 15 minutes.
And I guess we'll just kind of cut to the chase. What did you say?
Well, I ask everyone to raise a toast with me to our shared futures. You know, there's just that incredible quote from Martin Luther King that talks about us, you know, sharing the cloak of a common destiny. And let me see if I can think about this just for a moment, and I'll remember exactly what I said.
No worry.
Basically, I had what had happened was I took photographs. You know, I'm a photographer, so I took a slideshow of photographs, and I started off my talk by saying that I was not going to speak about the photographs as they played. They were just going to play on the large screen behind me as a silent witness to the irreversible devastation of my home and the people that I, you know, call family. And by the way, the second most biodiverse ecosystem in the entire world. And then I talked about the Martin Luther King quote, where he said, "We must all learn to live together as brothers and sisters, or we will all perish together as fools. We're tied together in a single garment of destiny, caught in an inescapable network of mutuality. And whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly." So that was what I opened it up with, the Martin Luther King quote. And I asked them if they knew who he was, and of course they did. But, you know, it's always good to come.
Right. You don't want to take things for granted.
Right. So then I asked them to, I said I'd like to propose a toast and asked everyone to raise their glass with me. Of course, you know, at all these roundtable meetings, they always have a bottle of water and stuff sitting in front of everybody. And I asked everyone to pour themselves a glass of water and let's have a toast, and we would have a drink to our shared destiny. And so everyone did that. And I said, you know, I know it's not normal to toast with water, and everybody kind of chuckled, but I said, given that the planet is 2/3 water and our bodies are somewhere around 3/4 water, I think whatever happens to the water on this planet happens to all of us. So we do have this shared destiny, if nothing else, at the very least through the water. And then at that point, I had a bottle from, it was one of their companies, you know, their water companies that had their bottled water there. And before the meeting, I had taken a jar of the filthy water from Printer, West Virginia, and I had put it into one of their water bottles.
No.
I had let it settle out so that it looked clear, and it was just kind of sitting on the table in front of me, and no one really noticed it because it looked like all the other bottles, you know, at a casual glance. But then after everyone had taken a drink of their water, I picked that up and I said, this is a bottle of water that came from a well in a community near where I live. And I turned the bottle upside down, still capped, but then all of the sediment in that bottle passes through and it turns almost pure black. And I said, "You would be rightfully disturbed if I told you you had just shared some of this water unaware. But that's just what's happening to the people where I live. They're drinking this water without knowing what's in it."
So I trust you got some sort of picture is worth a thousand words looks on their faces?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think people were really perked up then because the implication had been that I had just shared this dirty water with them because it was in the same bottle, that the same kind of bottle that they were all drinking from. And so...
So is that something that occurred to you before you left here?
Yeah. Yeah, it was my intention all along. I collected that bottle of water from one of the homes in Printer, and I packed it in my luggage very carefully and took it over there with the sole intent being, I think that, you know, a lot of people criticize me for the talks, and they say, well, you know, your talking is, you're certainly got a lot of nice words, but they're very emotional, and, you know, we need facts. And, you know, the truth is, there's plenty of facts. The facts have been known for quite some time. People need to understand. I mean, I think that bankers are so used to dealing with facts that to really get to them, it needed to touch them in the heart.
Right. And you know, I don't think that the research that's been done on human nature is exclusive to the American people, Paul. You have to get you have to hook them in their hearts.
Right.
Before you can access the leverage of their brains. Because we as humans have a remarkable ability to ignore facts, to our detriment.
Well, we as a species tend to ignore danger until it becomes a crisis. So, for instance, poison water in Appalachia is not a crisis to someone in Europe until they think they've been drinking that water, and then suddenly that's a crisis. You know. A personal crisis for them. So I just kind of wanted to let them do with it for a little bit to see, let them legitimately feel what it must be like to have to drink that water.
And, of course, bathe in it, cook with it, brush their teeth with it, live with it.
Bathe your children in it, have your children drinking this water. You know, there's a lot of things I might do myself, but I certainly wouldn't subject a child to it.
Absolutely. Well, you're getting a note in here. Dr. John just wrote in, and he said it's inspiring to hear about this cross-ocean activism. Thanks to Paul. It's a work that benefits all of us. Dr. John is very well versed in the struggle against mountaintop removal, and at his distance is trying to educate people outside this region about it, as have many. Many members of the Horn audience, the Horn family, as we call them here, Paul, have been integral in getting support for something that I know you know about, the AIC Act, H.R. 5959 at this point. It occurs to me, you know, I know you've read the data, the scientific reports that led to the creation or the drafting of the AIC Act. You know, this magnificent group that hosted you over there, that also hosted me, Urgewald, Urgewald.de. I keep thinking maybe, and I don't know how we would go about doing it. Maybe you check your contacts, I'll check mine. But we need, if they want facts, we've got lots of facts, don't we?
Oh, absolutely.
We need to get those reports, those scientific studies, the birth defect study, the mortality studies, the cancer and heart disease studies. We need to get those. It appears to me that we need to get those things translated into German, doesn't it?
I think that's definitely something that's already been started. They've asked me for a couple of those, and they're going to definitely be using some of those. There's 23 reports right now.
Right.
23 different reports. We're going to pick three of them, and they're going to have them translated, in particular, just the abstracts, you know, the most important parts of them. And use those things because they're very real. I mean, these things, you know, it's an unfortunate thing that for us, it's someone is taking a gamble and a risk with our life, but for bankers, it's a risk with the return on their investment or a perceived return on their investment. And so what better way to, come at them once they've already had the terror of wondering if they just drank that water than to say, well, look, you know, this is a bad investment for a number of reasons, not the least of which is now that the science is in, the lawyers are coming right behind it. And the lawsuits have already started, and they're going to keep going and keep going. There's going to be one lawsuit after another. And if you as a banker are invested in this industry in any way, whether it's whether you agree with mountaintop mining or not, mining in general is, coal mining is killing us. And ultimately, you'll have to pay for that. You know, you're going to be held liable for this. You mean notes that you are, you know, deals that you financed are not going to be, you're not going to get your money back because the company's going to be bankrupt from paying lawsuits.
Well, that's what I was, that's one of the points I tried to get across when I was over there. You know, how are they going to feel when the lawyers come for them? Because American lawyers for people who have been poisoned and injured, you know, there's a sort of general rule of thumb in American law that says sue them all and let God sort them out.
Right.
Or a jury, for that matter. And sooner or later, if history is any indicator, they will find their ways to those banking halls of power in Frankfurt and Zurich and Vienna.
Well, they will, and it will bite them hard. They will find out that finally the true cost of coal will have to be paid. And that true cost of coal is not what it costs to mine it, wash it, transport it, burn it. The true cost of coal is people in the communities, Bob, where you and I live, that are suffering and dying from illnesses related. You know, 4,000 more people every year die in Appalachia as a result of their exposure to coal.
Yeah,
4,000 additional deaths a year.
And those are 4,000 deaths in mountaintop removal communities, Paul.
That's correct.
That doesn't take into account the downwind and downstream effects of it.
Right.
So it may be an even higher number, but even at 4,000, that's roughly 11 people a day. So a little over once every 2 hours, if you go ahead and run the statistics on out, in the course of this program, somebody in a mountaintop removal community will die. So that Kevin Crutchfield can have a bigger profit and the shareholders can have a bigger quarterly profit. And that's, you know, that falls right into that category that Hannah Arendt talked about when she discussed the banality of evil. And I don't know how they can look in the mirror. I don't know how they, I guess, because we aren't real to them, because they don't think they've drunk that water. Is that what it is, Paul?
Well, I think it hasn't been real to them yet, but I think once their bottom line starts getting impacted dramatically, and it will get impacted dramatically. I mean, look what happened to Alpha. Alpha bought Massey thinking they were going to be on top of the world. They thought here they're going to buy this crippled company. They're going to end up being the number three holder of met coal reserves in the entire world. And they just thought everything was going to be lovely. Their stock was at 68 a share. Everything was golden. Well, what they didn't realize was the legacy cost of the irresponsibility of Massey under Don Blankenship and what they had done to poison these communities and the fact that they were going to have to start paying for those things. And now, you know, even though I think it's heinous that a judge has ordered settlements out of court and not forced them to pay the full cost that they would have had to pay because they knew they were going to be found guilty. Irregardless of that, they still had to pay millions upon millions of dollars for these cases in damages, not to mention what they paid those high-priced attorneys to try to defend themselves. So, yeah, these things are starting to hit. I mean, Alpha stock is less than $10 a share. Most days it's hovering around $5 or $6 a share. And, you know, Arch's stock is not much better. Patriot is all but bankrupt. I mean, they're just waiting for the judge to say they are, you know.
So a question coming in from Michael. He says, not to sound naive, but could you or Paul please draw the line for us that connects German bankers to mountaintop removal? Can we name names, banks, companies, I mean? Michael says, I think it would be instructive.
Well, we certainly can. I don't have those exact direct which bank is financing which company, but let me just say things like UBS, Deutsche Bank, and several other major banks are directly financing Alpha, Arch, Peabody, and Consol that we know of. They're financing, you know, projects and ongoing operations with at least those four companies.
And when I went over the data that was available when I was over there, what I was shocked to find out about, because I admit, Paul, I'm not a business mind.
I don't either. It was very startling to me, everything.
You know, I add 2 and 2 together and add 12 and carry 5, and, you know, sometimes I come up with things that involve exponential notation. But what I understood is that, yes, Commerzbank, Deutsche Bank, UBS, Royal Bank of Scotland, Credit Agricole in France, and a whole host of others. What they do is they lend money for operations, and they lend money for operations via bond issues. And we've got some financial minds in the Horn audience here who can probably even flesh it out further. But what happens is it's a little bit like loan sharking. If you go to a loan shark, there's always something called the VIG, the vigorish. And that's the money you get just for being willing to lend the money. And there's a VIG involved with these transactions. And what it will usually take the form of is a fee, a straight-out fee, that comes back to the bank via the lending process itself. And there is a percentage that is paid as a commission for bonds purchased. So when they go out and sell these bonds, a part of the purchase price comes back to the bank. So they're not just, it's not just like Paul or Bob goes to the car lot and goes and gets a loan and purchases the car and we pay interest on the loan. There's that too. But there are layers upon layers upon layers of ways that these international finance banks find to get their money. And so even if the bonds tank, they're still making money off of it, because one of the oldest rules of business is get the money up front. And they're doing that. And so it's American banks, it's banks on the continent, it's banks in the UK. And they're red-handed on it. Now, I think you probably had a similar experience to mine in that they'll say, well, you know, we might loan them money, but we're not loaning them money for mountaintop removal. Did you get that one?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I got that from a couple of the banks. They said, well, yes, it's true that we do business with some of these operations, but our bank has a policy that strictly prohibits us lending money for mountaintop removal projects.
So basically, the coal company is then saying, "Oh no, we're gonna use this to redecorate the home office. We're not gonna use this for mountaintop removal. This isn't gonna go to buy ammonium nitrate and fuel oil explosives. This isn't gonna go to buy giant Caterpillar machinery. Oh heck no, we'll do some underground mining and oh I don't know, we'll feed some puppies and kittens with it. But no, there's not gonna be." And that, of course, is nothing but a wholesale lie, because you cannot separate the activities of a massive company like Alpha, for instance, or Peabody or Arch. You can't separate one from the other.
Well, of course you can't. I mean, you know, that'd be like saying we're going to fund the United States government, but we're not going to fund the war in Afghanistan. Well, of course you are. You know, if you're funding our government, you're funding everything our government does. If you're funding a bank, or if a bank is financing a mining company, they're financing everything that company does. And when you're financing an industry that's poisoning people to death, you are financing death. Plain and simple.
Well, I tell you what, I really do. I applaud. It is an enjoyable trip. I'm sure you had. It's hard to come back here after being over there in many ways, except for one's loved ones being here. You got to experience some real live, honest to goodness, straight up civilization, I'm sure. But coming back, you realize that this kind of work has to be done. There's work that has to be done on the ground here. This state just got more brutal as of this past Tuesday. I don't know if you noticed, but it did.
Yeah, I did.
We got rid of the teabaggers and such. Got rid of Daryl McGraw in favor of a guy who will probably be little more than a tool of the coal industry, so that just adds one more tool to their toolbox. I'm talking about this cat named Morrissey. The House of Delegates got a little bit more Republican, which means that's a few more people who think that we're here for the poisoning, or more than that, just ignore the science altogether. If we can turn the focus a little bit back more toward here, what do we do, Paul? In your estimation, what do we do to wake people up, both in Appalachia and in the country at large?
Well, I think that's the million-dollar question, really. But I think it's we put one foot in front of the other, and we reach one person at a time. Unfortunately, I don't know that there's any way to get across to the masses in any direct way, because we don't have the gazillions of dollars that the fossil fuel industries have to buy every billboard and buy full-page ads in every newspaper every day. I mean, you know, that's clearly all this marketing that's been done in Appalachia. I mean, this is a Madison Avenue thing. They have sold us a bill of goods here in this state and other mining areas, and made it all into this flag waving thing. And I mean, what's patriotic about killing people? And my question really comes back to why can't we honor our heritage without living in the past? And that's what we have to do. I think we have to find.
That's a magnificent way of expressing it.
Forward-thinking people who are willing to understand that concept. Let me put it personally. My dad was a coal miner, and my grandfathers were all coal miners. I'm the first male in my family to not mine coal. I don't think there's anything dishonorable about my father or my grandfathers. I have every respect for them. They put their life on the line every day to make sure there was food on my table and a roof over my head, and I'm grateful for that. But, you know, the same thing could be said of the men who were digging the Hawk's Nest Tunnel. But they all died as a result of it. So should we be proud of the fact that they all died and carry ourselves to an untimely death as well, just to honor them? Or should we take the gift they gave us, which is a gift of life, really, and then try to move forward and gain some progress on that? And that's the thing here in the coal field. West Virginia fueled the Industrial Revolution, and there's really no good reason why West Virginia can't fuel the Green Revolution. The problem is the politicians who need to either become leaders of vision or get the hell out of the way. It's just that simple. Become a leader of vision or get the hell out of the way.
You know, you and I share that factor in common. My dad was a coal miner, my father, my grandfather, my great-grandfather, And I, too, the first male in my family not to go down in the hole. And my father never looked at, never spoke wistfully of his time in the mines. He never spoke of it as something romantic. But somehow, one of the great marketing Madison Avenue moments that we've had, Paul, is that it has been romanticized here.
It's been completely romanticized, and it's tragic, you know, because the truth of it is, you know, my dad, he always told me I could do whatever I wanted with my life as long as it was honest. And then about the time I was graduating from high school and heading off to college, which, of course, was a great gift that my dad gave me, in that he insisted that I go get an education.
Same here.
And he said, you know, I've always told you you can do whatever you want as long as it was honest. Well, I've changed my mind. You can do whatever you want to do as long as it's honest and as long as you never, ever, ever set foot in a coal mine. Because he said, I'll tell you this much, son, that ain't no life for a man.
Nope, it's not.
Now, gasping for breath, dying of black lung, and broken down from working in the coal mines his whole life, and every other man in my family, I mean, would anybody really, really want that for their kids? I mean, what is patriotic about that?
Nothing. And of course, the coal industry, and I think at considerable disservice to the people with whom they're comparing themselves, they like to compare themselves to soldiers.
Well, and they do, and that's why they've got this whole thing that there's a war on coal. Well, there's a war on clean air.
There's a war on people. There's a war on innocent victims who have no means of fighting back save by doing the kind of things that you, Paul, do every day. I'll go ahead and say, I know your dad, and I think he is I haven't seen him in a couple of years, but he is a magnificent man. And I was most honored, on a trip I got to take to D.C. with him. And you know what the truth he speaks is real truth. It's not colored by bitterness. It's not colored by some desire to exact revenge. It's simply tinged with the tint of a life lived with this industry. And, you know, it's so distressing during the campaign season when I saw a quote from somebody saying, well, I got children 5 and 6 years old, and what are they going to do with their lives if they can't mine coal? And I wanted to put my head into it. I mean, I wanted to kick furniture, Paul.
I know.
That's not the question. The question is, how am I going to keep my kids out of this poison?
That's exactly it. I mean, and besides the fact of that, so many of these people, I mean, you know, let's be clear about those 4,000 people that we're losing additionally every year in Appalachia. A lot of those people are not coal miners. A great significant proportion of those people are citizens living in the communities around these sites. They're not the people working on these sites.
No.
And that's the thing. I mean, who would suffer and go through all that pain and turmoil knowing good and well that they're shortening their lives by a dramatic number of years if they're lucky enough to not be killed on the job?
And we, you and I have...
We'll get to have that future, too.
Yeah, you and I have personal friends who now rest beneath the earth who were not coal industry people, who, in fact, did what they could with their lives to make sure that no more had to die. Judy Bonds died extremely young.
Very young.
And you can say as well that Larry Gibson died young. You know, the heart attack, cut and brush on top of his mountain. What's left of a mountain. He used to have to look up at the mountains. He lived in a little nestled paradise that was surrounded and shielded by lush green mountains that's now the high point over acres upon acres of barren moonscape where a crow flying across has to pack a lunch.
Yep. Thousands of acres surround his home, and it's nothing but devastation. There's nothing there.
And it is wholly unacceptable for a culture to indiscriminately and arbitrarily simply sacrifice 4,000 of its people every year so that somebody else can buy a new pickup truck, a four-wheeler, and a tanning bed bulbs. That's extremely bothersome to me, and I'll go one step further. I said this on the program last night, Paul. The UMWA did itself a real disservice when it couldn't find it in its heart to endorse Barack Obama. Because there is no war on coal. I think we both agree, right?
There is no war on coal. There is not. I mean, and you know, when was the last time a Republican politician had any compassion on any labor union?
None.
I don't remember. I mean, the Republican Party is very anti-labor union.
I mean, what does it stand for when workers on an Ohio mine site were compelled, with no pay, to stand as a human backdrop, you know, human beings reduced to nothing more than set props for a political ad for Willard Romney.
Right.
It's obscene.
It is obscene. And you know what's really obscene is the whole flag waving thing. Let me tell you what patriotic is. Patriotic was John F. Kennedy saying, I think that this nation should commit itself before the end of this decade to putting a man on the moon and returning him safely to the earth. The best engineers in the world said it can't happen by the end of this decade. It probably can't even happen by the end of the century. But John Kennedy had a dream, and he shared that dream, and he instilled people with that fire. And guess what? In less than a decade, We'd not put one, but we'd put several men on the moon and brought them back safely. That's patriotism. That's a nation saying, no matter what the challenge, we're going to rise to this challenge. We're going to overcome this. We're going to do it together. We're not going to step on each other to get it done. We're going to take care of each other as a country, and we are going to win this race, the space race. And that's what we did. That's something to wave a flag about. That's something to call patriotism, because we saw an obstacle and we overcome it. Not this whole Madison Avenue marketing, trying to convince people, not just trying, but they've successfully convinced people that without coal, there's no other option. You know, the politicians in West Virginia say, you either have coal or you have poverty. Well, why do we only get to choose option A or option B?
Well, but we have coal and we have poverty.
Well, you know, let's talk about that. The five counties in West Virginia that produce the most coal are among the five poorest counties in the entire United States. And that statistic is not just borne out in the five counties in West Virginia. That statistic is actually borne out globally. Areas which are rich in natural resources, particularly in minerals or things like gold and diamonds and stuff, those areas are traditionally among the poorest of any other area.
Absolutely.
Why? Because the industry that's raping and pillaging the environment and the communities is the one that's making the real profit, and it's at everybody else's expense.
And it should be borne in mind that they're never the people who do the extraction are never happy. I'm getting ready to take of late, I have found myself going to Wisconsin fairly frequently and have absolutely fallen in love with that state. And I'm going back there in December, Paul, because you know who Chris Klein is, right?
Yes.
He's one of those coal barons. He's got a yacht called Mine Games, you know, because human lives are just a damn game to him.
Well,
he knows the handwriting's on the wall in Appalachia, because they're running out of mountains to blow up. They're running out of coal seams to get at. So he has turned his eye toward the hills of northern Wisconsin, and he intends to go and introduce mountaintop removal to the hills of northern Wisconsin, not to get at coal, but to get at taconite, an iron bearing ore. And I'm going out there with my hair on fire, trying to help and encourage and maybe, you know, provide a little impetus for doing things like starting baseline health surveys so they can know what the health of the community is before these people come in, so that they can say, this is where we are and we do not want to go one step backwards.
Well, that's absolutely right. And I mean, I'm so grateful to you for doing that. I tell you, it's just hugely important, and they can take a look at southern West Virginia if they want to see what they've got waiting for them.
Yeah, and I told them the last time I was out there, y'all don't want to be us. And what beautiful, I mean beautiful country it is. And they've got a magnificent state environmental regulation kind of legal scheme, but their state house in both the House and the Senate, and of course Scott Walker is the governor, just went over to the Republicans in the majority in both houses, and they're going to come with their teeth bared and their fangs dripping for that environmental law. So, you know, if there can be any help had out of the suffering here, I hope we can pass it along.
Well, and whatever I can do to help on that too, you know I'm here.
Absolutely. Well, we don't get together in person nearly as much as we should, but I hope we can sit down and have a cup of coffee or a cold glass of beer or something sometime soon. Paul Corbett Brown, welcome home. Like I said, I know that it was an eye-opening experience for you. Of course, you've been all over the planet. Before we go, tell people just a little bit about, we've talked about coal, but that is not all you've seen in the way of human rights abuses, and you have made human rights your life's work. Tell people a little bit more about what you've done.
Well, I've photographed human rights issues pretty much anywhere they've occurred. I mean, I've been to Rwanda several times doing a documentary project on the aftermath of the genocide. I've done work in the Kibera slums, which is just outside of Nairobi. It's the second largest slum in the world. I've done work with street kids in Indonesia and orphans in Russia, and I've been to Palestine and seen what's going on there, and you know, documented those kind of things. And for me, really, the camera is a wonderful vehicle to give people a voice, and that's just simply what I hope to do with it, is to use that little machine to give people a voice who otherwise might not have had one.
Well, can you because you have seen such manifest horrors in other places, and it's certainly not a competition, but can you place what's going on here in Central Appalachia in any kind of perspective, on any kind of continuum? Is that even possible?
I don't know where I would put it, but I can tell you that a man that I interviewed a couple of years ago told me he had spent 4 tours, I think, in Iraq, and he came back. He lives in Mingo County. He came back to Mingo County. He was a troop leader. I don't know. I don't know a lot about the military and different ranks and all that, but he was a leader. And he came back to his home in Mingo County, and he said the thing that shook him the most was thinking, my God, I've just spent 4 tours in Iraq supposedly giving to the Iraqi people what people in my own community don't have. We don't have a government that's responsive, that cares for us and protects us. We are being, you know, decimated at every turn by all kinds of evil. We don't have clean water to drink. We don't have any kind of a significant infrastructure like good roads or reliable electricity. He said, you know, here we've been fighting this war in Iraq supposedly to liberate these people and to bring them these things. He said, I'm just wondering if when we're done in Iraq, we could come to Mingo County and we can have the same things there.
And it's the truth for anyone who's never seen it. The word third world gets bandied around in discussions about Appalachia, but it is honest to God true, isn't it, Paul?
Well, when you can't drink the water, I mean, look at Blair. You know, look at Blair, the community of Blair. I mean, here is the site of the largest civil insurrection in the history of the United States outside of the Civil War. 10,000 miners took up arms to say that they demanded fair labor laws and to be treated fairly as workers in the coal industry. Once again, the coal industry has never been anybody's friend. But here's all that labor movement affected everyone in this world that enjoys those labor laws. And yet, the site of that history is now on the verge of being blown up by Alpha and Arch and NRP, who owns the land. And the people in those communities already can't drink the water. They can't drink the water. The water is not safe to drink. How many communities in southern West Virginia where you have to bring your own water when you go there because you can't drink the tap water?
Well, and when you start talking about things like that, Paul, how do you talk about it without beginning to use euphemisms like ethnic cleansing?
Well, listen, you know, Raphael Lemkin, who is the man who dedicated his life to seeing to it that genocide was outlawed, he invented that word. He created the word genocide, and he spent his life lobbying international courts to try to get them to, A, acknowledge there was such a crime as genocide, and B, to outlaw it, and C, to define exactly what was a genocide. And genocide was not just a military campaign of murdering people. Raphael Lemkin said that a genocide was any decimation of an ethnic group or a culture of people. Anything that destroys, systematically dismantles a culture of people is genocide. I know a lot of people don't like to use that word. They think it's way overused, or they think it's a little bit too strong for this situation. It's like, well, after you've seen a certain number of your family members die way before their time and unnecessarily and as a result of being poisoned, then you come back and tell me how you feel about that word.
I know I've heard that same criticism. Well, no, this, and it always comes in the way of, a some sort of comparative scale. Well, you know, what's going on in southern Appalachia or in central Appalachia, you know, that's not the same thing that happened in Rwanda. That's not the same thing that happened in the Sudan. That's not the same thing that happened during World War II. But that is to suggest that genocide is something static, when the people who commit it are infinitesimally, or infinitely, I should say, infinitely creative in accomplishing it.
Well, I mean, look, they want to force people out of their homes. The people who have lived in some of these homes for generations, their family have inhabited the same structure for generations. I mean, you know, think about Appalachian culture. We have our own music. We have our own sense of humor. We have our own words.
Cuisine.
We have our own dances. I mean, we're a culture of people, and that's being systematically dismantled by forcing us to, for lack of better words, a diaspora. You know, we're going to the four winds so that we can be employed, or so that we don't have to be choked on the dust from the mining operation, or so we can have clean water to drink. And, you know, I mean, let me just put it to you this way, or to the listeners this way. What's the difference between killing someone quick or killing someone slow? You know, when I testified in front of the United Nations 2 years ago in Dublin, Ireland, about what was happening here, I put that out there. I said, you know, the death of my people is not coming quickly at the end of a gun. It comes very slowly from the simple act of drawing water from your sink. And this is the truth. People are being poisoned to death. And so if someone poisons you and it takes a month or a year or even 5 years for you to notice that poisoning, have they any less poisoned you? No.
And the victims are certainly no less dead.
And you are no less dead when your time's up. And when you think, I think that Mingo County, women in Mingo County have one of the shortest life expectancies of any demographic in the United States. I mean, imagine that. 71 years, I think, is what it was.
And falling.
Yeah. So, you know, the coal industry says, look at all we've given you. Look at all we've given you. We've given you this.
As if we're ingrates.
And I said, you know, I told one of them one day, I said, you know, I do look at what you've given me. I say, I look at the food on my table as a distraction from the fact that you've poisoned the vessel we drink from. I said, I look at the fact that my dad's gasping for breath every day, like so many thousands of other men have done, and women now, with black lung. I look at the fact that the places where you're most active are among the poorest places in the entire nation. Believe me, buddy, I've looked at everything the coal industry has given this state.
Yeah, killing us with kindness, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think the young man in Mate One said it best. He said, you know, that first they came to say they were here to help us with this, and then somebody else came here to say they were here to help us. He said, buddy, we've had about all the help we can stand.
It's the truth. And that other favorite line of mine from that magnificent movie, all we got in common is our misery.
Yeah.
The least we can do is share it.
Yeah.
Well, it's about time we stopped sharing misery and started sharing a little bit of success, a little bit of prosperity. And again, Paul Corbett Brown, I am awfully, awfully thankful that you're out there in the struggle, and I am honored that you are a friend, a neighbor, a colleague, and a comrade.
Oh, I feel the same about you too, Bob. I could never tell you how grateful I am for you and all you've done. You've just done an incredible amount, and I'm really very, very grateful for it. So thank you.
Well, hopefully we will get together soon. You know, we got together a little bit back, and you know, you talk about the water. It is stirring, stunning, horrifying when you stand at the drift mouth of a mine 100 years old and that thing is still flowing poison.
Yep.
And that's, you know, it's not like it's the only one in the state of West Virginia. They're all over eastern Kentucky. They're all over southwest Virginia. They're in Tennessee. They're in Alabama. They're in West Virginia. And in many instances, they're not even charted or mapped and no attempt to deal with it.
No, none whatsoever. And now we're finding among those scientific studies that the aquatic wildlife in these streams has been genetically mutated from heavy metal poisoning that's coming off of these mine sites. Imagine that. The aquatic wildlife has become genetically mutated because of heavy metal poisoning. So everything that on the upside of the food chain from that organism is being poisoned and subjected to genetic mutations. I mean, think of that. And you know, heavy metal poisoning is like radiation. Once it's in your body, it's just in your body, and it eventually accumulates until it kills you.
Right. The same way that the Mad Hatter became mad.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kate just wrote in from Montana, and she said, "Hey, in the list of what's wonderful in West Virginia culture, you forgot the ramps."
Oh, absolutely.
ramps, the mushrooms. God, the moonshine.
Moonshine.
And you know what? You can't make that without these. You know, if you don't have good water, you ain't going to have no good shine.
No, not going to make good shine with acid mine drainage, that's for sure.
No, not at all. Well, Paul, thank you very much. Have a wonderful evening. I know you've got somewhere to be in a little bit, but hopefully we'll extend this conversation another day, and we'll keep folks posted on what you're doing and what the rest of us are doing and this ongoing effort to, well, you know, the New York Times called it Appalachia's agony. And it's about damn time it stopped.
Well, you know what my grandpa used to say? He said the sun doesn't shine up the same dog's ass every day. I mean, these people have had their day and now it's ours. And I think that I just want to encourage everybody, you know, everybody has something positive to offer. Everybody has something to offer to move us forward, and we just need to work together, and let's get there. Let's make this happen, and let's show people what it looks like when we work together and get stuff done. Because, you know, we are can-do people. I think we've kind of forgotten it a little bit.
I think you're right. Paul, have a wonderful evening, and thanks again for your time tonight.
Thank you, Bob. I appreciate you and all your listeners. Talk to you soon.
Take care. Bye now. Paul Corbett Brown, world-renowned photographer and resident of Fayette County, West Virginia, and tireless worker in the struggle for Appalachian dignity, Appalachian human rights, and Appalachian self-determination, hillbilly self-determination. Kate did write in just a minute ago under the subject line of, "What'd I miss?" Ron and Raleigh, you started something. "Hey, y'all, I just got in. Who won?" "I jokes," she says. "I turned off all my media last weekend and haven't paid any attention to the BS. Imagine my surprise when I tuned in to all that is still BS. You get the idea that the for-profit media have a really ugly case of ADHD, or maybe it's OCD. Once they decide they're going to talk about something, they talk about something till there's nothing left about it to talk about, and then they keep talking about it. It's mighty frustrating. Kate said, "This interview was very informative but heartbreaking." Then she says to the listeners, "Come on, folks. There was $100 laying on the table. Now we need only 50 to pick it up. 1 hour's gone by, and a week in November. In order to have a December, we have to come forward. Imagine, if you will, what it will be like when you log on and the mic isn't hot. Please, just $5 or $10 will add up. Thank you in advance." And she's right. We have $50 to go to meet tonight's challenge, which will put us $50 past tonight's $150 goal and go along and take steps toward covering what didn't happen yesterday, the day before. It's about 25 minutes past the hour. I wanted to make sure that we had the phone lines, I wanted to make sure that we had time for my conversation with Paul because, well, how can I put this? Yes, that's true. That's true, Betsy. Some of us contributed already this month. You have. And that's why this is a team effort. This is not saying give more than you've already given. This is a matter of saying we've all got a stake in this. Indeed, Betsy, indeed. Thank you. Now, I wanted to make sure that, you hear from me talking about mountaintop removal a lot. There are a lot of other people working on the issue. My colleague, dear friend, comrade, neighbor two mountain ridges over and an hour and a half away. That's the way the lay of the land works around here. Two ridges over, but I'm an hour and a half away by car. Bo Webb is getting ready to renew the effort on the AHEC Act, the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Act. You can go a long way toward helping us stop mountaintop removal by helping us get more co-sponsors for the AHEC Act. The more we get during this lame duck session of Congress, the more we can expect to have as sort of automatic sign-ons in the new Congress, and that means all the more resources can be poured into getting new co-sponsors. And this is a truly grassroots effort that you can be proud of. This isn't something that was cooked up in the minds of the marketing department of some big green as a fundraising vehicle. They're very good at that, you know. No, this is something that was recognized as an utter necessity by people who live with, deal with, and have seen the consequences of mountaintop removal firsthand, who live underneath mountaintop removal operations. AHEACT.org, AHEACT.org is where you go to learn about it. Those studies I was talking about, they're all accessible from the website. All the data you need with which to convince your elected representative. And don't be shy if it's a Republican, call them. Don't give them a pass on this. They're pro-life. Well, how can you be pro-life and be unwilling to sign a bill that would actually stop the poisoning of babies in the womb? Right? So go to AHEACT.org and really take great pleasure in knowing that you're participating in something that you can tell your kids, your grandkids, your neighbors' grandkids, that you helped make happen. The cessation of an assault in central Appalachia that rises to the level of warfare. Remember what Paul Corbett Brown said about that returning Iraq war veteran. He came home and realized that what he had been allegedly fighting to bring to Iraq wasn't even available in his own home. AHEACT.org. So the phone lines are open. 304-658-3333 is the phone system line. We don't have toll-free service anymore because the folks who provide it are holding it hostage over a disputed bill. So 304-658-3333 is how you get involved with the program on the telephone. But being all high-tech like we are, we also have a Skype account, and you can get in on Skype. If you've got a Skype account, too, all you have to do is contact us. The handle here is Bob Kincaid Horn, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D-H-O-R-N, Bob Kincaid Horn, and we can you can be involved in the program that way. It's a lovely little night in the chat room. Chat room's free and easy to access. Head on radionetwork.com/chatroom. Just pick out a username and a password and jump right in. We are now at only $30 away from meeting Shirley's challenge for this evening. So we're making real progress. 304-658-3333 or Bob Kincaid Horn on Skype. And at exactly the halfway mark of tonight's Thorn in the Side Thursday program, let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello, Will from Chicago here. How are you?
Hey, Will, how you doing?
Good, good, good. Recovering from a cold. Got to do some of what you're doing. Still continuing with the job hunting. The good news is at least I had two interviews this past month, so I think things are beginning to pick up. But, I mean, the economy is still going to take a while to recover because unlike what a certain Mr. Romney portrayed, this was not a typical recession, but a deep one where we had a systemic failure, namely our banking and regulatory system such as it was under George W. Bush crashed, and we had two years of a very obstinate House of Representatives, and even before that, obstinate. So I'm not holding my breath to see if the House will change its tune, but I do have a few concerns, even though I'm very happy with many of the election results, one of which is hoping that we don't get a grand bargain to save us from the fiscal cliff that ends up impacting Social Security and Medicare.
Well, let's talk about that for just a minute, Will.
Sure.
The Bush tax cuts were passed, and they had a sunset clause on them. That thing has already been extended once.
Exactly.
How to put this? With his last campaign behind him, why shouldn't Barack Obama just say no? The damn thing's going to expire. That's all there is to it. And if the Republican Congress does not want to do something for the middle class, then let it be upon their heads. Is there any reason that shouldn't happen?
No. I like to say one of Obama's quirks as a politician is a strength that can be a weakness depending on who you're dealing with. He's very good at wanting to see compromises, and with reasonable people, such as you might have when you're a community organizer who wants to try to resolve a problem where everyone has a vested interest in solving it, yeah, compromise can work. But I'm not sure it'll work with the current Republicans, although John Boehner might be willing to cooperate if only to frustrate Cantor. But Obama should live without fear on this and say, look, after the elections, I met with Congress and asked them, let's end the tax cuts for the richest Americans. And what do they do? No. It's just that there's part of me which thinks that a good chunk of the Republican leadership would be perfectly happy to kick us into a recession out of spite.
Well, I'm afraid there's truth in that, but by the same token, coming from where I do, Will, compromise is lovely.
Yeah.
But there are some things, for instance, here in Central Appalachia, we can't sit down at the table with the coal companies and say, well, okay, blow this mountain up, but not that one.
Right.
Because there are some things that inure or should inure to the benefits of everyone. I don't think you can compromise on Medicare because, frankly, they have no right, and it's already been done to, I'm not sure how old you are, but it's already been done to my generation. I don't get to retire till 67 now for some reason that passes understanding, except to say that people who didn't have a dog in that hunt decided to screw my generation. We can't make that determination anymore. They have no right to take away something from someone who, and that's the assumption that's made. Well, you know, these 22, 23-year-olds, they don't even think they're ever going to die. Let's play with their Social Security. Let's play with their Medicare.
It's going to enrage people. I mean, here's the thing. I can barely conceive of a 67-year-old bricklayer or a pipe fitter. I can't imagine one being one at age 70 or seeing someone do it. And I think Obama's best stand is to just be bold, go out there, and if the GOP acts like it merely wants to be the party of the 1%, let them be, expose them, and work around them by all means possible via executive orders, what you can get done in the Senate, and the like. And I mean, considering everything that was hurled against Obama and the Democrats in this election, there are some great results. I mean, we have some great new senators, particularly Elizabeth Warren. I'm not too fond of Joe Donnelly, where I live here in northwest Indiana, just outside the city, but guess what? Is he preferable to Richard Murdoch? Absolutely. Why? Because it keeps the speaker's gavel further away from Mitch McConnell. And I hope that the president decides to go bold, and if the GOP just wants to be another do-nothing Congress, I would start planning on portraying them as such as soon as possible so that by the time the 2014 elections go around, there'll be some social diseases with higher favorability than Congress.
I agree. And you know, you say that Donnelly, his biggest selling point is basically that he's not a right wing, that he's not technically a Republican. I understand that, Will, because that's about the only thing you can say for Joe Manchin here in West Virginia, if you can say that about him. Because what scares me is that he's already making those come on, let's everybody work together for the common good. But what he means work together when he says work together for the common good, let's work together to take apart Medicare, let's work together to kill Social Security. And there's a mindset there that says that's the only alternative, and it's that there is no alternative mindset that is going to be the death of all of it.
Right, and that there are options. And guess what? Everywhere where these austerity policies have been tried, they have been miserable failures, increasing human suffering. I shared earlier in the Horn chat room a story from Greece, which talked about the rise of the Golden Dawn.
Oh, they're a frightening bunch. I mean, they're just straight-up fascists.
Exactly. I mean, they have actually had one of their candidates punch another candidate on a political stage, encouraging violence. And I think we need our social safety net more than ever. And if the wealthiest Americans can't pay for it, well, guess what? They already benefiting a lot from us having court systems and infrastructure, so let them pay. Do not touch on the benefits that millions of Americans have worked for. These are not entitlements, per se. These are things that we have invested in.
No, they're bought and paid for.
Checking. They're bought and paid for. I mean, they are more secure than the casino that's called Wall Street.
So by a long shot.
By a long shot. I mean, heck, I would like to see the Bush tax cuts repealed. I would like to see the Reagan tax cuts repealed because we have tried trickle-down economics. It is as big a failure as the theory that bleeding someone of the bad humors in their body is going to kill them of their illnesses, the things that led to medical treatments that probably didn't more harm than good for people like George Washington and people of his era. I think progressives also need to do things outside of Congress. One, precinct captains. If you can get involved in your local Green Party, a Democratic Party, get involved in local level, you have the power to do something the Tea Party did in 2010. Slate candidates. And even if it's just for county board a state rep, that will give you influence down the road when you go to the party conventions on the state level and say, okay, I want to support a more progressive candidate for this vacant House seat. Similarly, we need to work on our farm teams. We need to have more progressives run, and fortunately there were more of that one. I'm very happy that Alan Grayson is coming back to Congress because he will say the things a lot of other people won't. But, I mean, we have to remember, Republicans are already thinking about 2014 and 2016. So we need to, as progressives, get involved and start dealing with the issues, because if we don't raise our voices, those who have wealth and power will. And, I mean, the guest you had illustrated that. If it weren't for the financial influence of big coal and big oil and other energy industries, we would be further along to a more sustainable energy policy.
Exactly. And, you know, Paul Corbett Brown was talking about patriotism a little bit ago. I know this is silly, but imagery and hooking people in the heart really matter. I think there ought to be a really sturdy American flag flying from the top of every wind turbine in the United States.
I would love that. I've seen several here in the Midwest, and when I traveled across country, I would put them on every wind turbine, near every solar plant. And it is true that we tend to fall on emotions. I don't know if you've ever read Drew Weston's The Political Brain, but Democrats too often presume that we respond like Vulcans, based from Star Trek, perfectly logical, being basing everything on facts and logic. First, as human beings, we tend to react by emotions. And this is why having voices like the horn is important. And I will suggest to anyone in the listening audience, if you can help out, do so. Heck, if somebody wins Powerball, please consider giving Bob Kincaid that turbine generator so that he can actually say one day on the air, no mountains were harmed in this broadcast.
It is something we have dreamed about for years, and that's no joke.
I know. I mean, here's the thing. We have it nearby in the city of Chicago closed down some ugly coal-polluting plants simply because they're not needed anymore. Yes, we do have nuclear plants here in the Midwest. We need to do more with sustainable energy. But guess what? Give people the opportunity to go with sustainable energy, and they will. And I think we're going to see a lot of technological strides in terms of storage, in terms of production. We have a lot of potential. So if we work on it, we can really get things done and go about and come up with a more sustainable economy and ecology. Because guess what? It was rare that years back we had storms like Sandy. Last October, we had a major snowstorm in New England. This year, we have Hurricane Sandy, which has devastated areas as far south as Nashville up to New England. And when you have people who are as business interested as Bloomberg saying we have to support candidates who actually believe in global climate change, that shows me that even the business community is wising up and realizes, hey, we're in trouble. So if we start funding technologies where we can deal with more sustainable resources, there'll be some bright person who will say, oh, look, I have just figured a way to make grids more productive, store things, and hopefully the coal industry will go the way of the dinosaur. Because quite literally, where you live, mountains that have existed for hundreds of millions of years, before fishes even climbed out of the ocean, are being torn down to get rocks. If you were to explain this to someone from another planet with, let's say, technology 1,000 more years advanced than our own, I don't know, maybe what you'd see in Star Trek, they would say,
oh, Will's phone must have died. Sorry about that. Well, sorry about that, Will. But I think I get where he's going. It's interesting. He mentioned that one book that said we all tend to approach these things as logical creatures. You know where my mind goes. It is arguably one of the best pieces of fiction of the 20th century, and it's certainly one of my favorite books. Robert Penn Warren's All the King's Men. Early in that book, when the guy who will become the boss, Willie Stark, is not the boss yet, he's just a chump. He's a guy who's been suckered into running for governor because his vanity was played upon. And he's a smart man. And he's got this stump speech that he uses where he says, what we need is a fair and equitable tax plan in this state, and begins to reel off numbers and figures until people in the audience's eyes begin to roll back in their heads. And there's this moment, this really critical moment in the book. I don't know if you get that in either of the movies that's been made of, but in the book there's this moment where someone tells him, look, ditch the facts and figures speeches. People don't give a damn about facts and figures. Tell them you're going to soak the fat boys and stand back and wait for the applause. And I thought about that when Will was talking, but I also was reminded further of it when I just got this email in from Andy. Out in California, Andy writes, let's start off the negotiations with the Repiglicans, similar to how President Franklin D. Roosevelt approached the tax issue in 1941. Top tax bracket pays 100% after the first $200,000, and then possibly negotiate down to 94%. That, says Andy, is negotiation. And you know, the exact opposite of that is what John Boehner has already done. Well, okay, I'll compromise with you, Mr. President. Here's my compromise. Let's not tax the rich. You know, this is a so-called lame duck session of Congress. President Obama has already got plenty of miles on his wheels from the campaign. What's a few more miles? You've got people out there, millions of people, 59 million plus, who are still feeling good about having reelected him. Get out there and bring their pressure to bear to let the Bush tax cuts expire. This is not rocket science. This is politics. And Otto von Bismarck said politics is the art of the possible. And with a victory fresh in their minds, it is possible to bring enough pressure to bear to get this job done. There's work that has to be done with my generation. We have to start objecting to what has already been done to us. Even more young, putting the lie to the right wing, even more young people turned out to vote this past Tuesday than did 4 years ago. Engage them now. Don't you dare touch our Social Security, because it is their Social Security. It's my Social Security. It's your Social Security. Don't you dare touch it. grand bargain. No, it's neither grand nor a bargain to bargain away a future generation's right to some semblance of dignity in their old age, whether they acknowledge that they will ever have it or not. That's fact. But some of this has to be some thinking that goes against the grain of Tina. There is no alternative. There is an alternative. And the alternative is that we fight back against these punks and thugs in the House of Representatives. They've already seen their ranks shrunk. Well, you won't have Alan West to kick around anymore. Crazy-ass Joe Walsh is gone, baby, gone. I was thinking about Joe Walsh. Anybody, and this is, I don't mean for every night there to be a new wager on the horn. Anybody want to bet how long it takes him to file for a modification of his child support obligation based upon the fact that he is now unemployed? I've got, the day after he leaves office. I'm sure the papers are already being drafted. I'm poor. Wonder how many of those social safety nets turning into hammocks he'll take advantage of. Of course, he's probably not a broke man in the first place. But if you don't think, well, he's entitled to it. He's all shiny with his white privilege. Right? Sure. Now, something inside me just says, yeah, we'll be hearing that. Just to let you know, Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen's Green News Report will not be rolling this evening because they took the week off from producing the Green News Report because of the election. I sure understand that. Thanks very much, everybody. We are very close to meeting Shirley's challenge for this evening. We are at $80. We've only got 20 to go. And that'll take care of a little bit of last night and all of tonight. Meaning that Tuesday we've got to take care of. And then we'll be set for raising tomorrow night's amount. The PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com, as is the snail mail address, 1038 The Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318, Beckley, Beckley, WV 25801. So we'll take a little break, and we'll come back to your calls. Or an hour of filibustering. You pick. You know the number, 304-658-3333. Or on Skype, Bob Kincaid Horn, BobKincaidHorn. Either way, works just dandy. This is Conversation Radio, listener supported. In its eighth year, this is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
Total Genius. It's not your mother's soap.
Hey, dude, wait 1 second. It's totally my mother's soap.
Total Genius. It's not your father's soap.
No. See, right here, I've got soap for my dad.
And you know what? It's not just soap. Look, it's stuff for my dog.
Holy crap! There's even stuff for all my pregnant friends.
And hippies.
And hey, dude, loosen that tie. Try it again.
Total Genius. We got your soap right here.
And got their bath and body stuff.
www.doublegenius.com.
Tonight's final hour of Head On begins now. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Buck.
Yes, indeed. 8 p.m. straight up here in the Eastern Standard Time Zone. Live from the hills and hollers of almost level West by Dodd, Virginia. This is The Horn. I am Bob Kincaid. I got a magnificent photo montage from Sandra earlier today of white people grieving because I guess the white horse pulled up lame. White horse. Please, may we never have another Mormon run for national office, please. But I scrolled through those photographs and they were indeed something special. I mean, this was everything short of sackcloth and ashes. These heartbroken white folks. And there's even a story coming out of, it's kind of a non-story, I guess, coming out of West Virginia. Most of this collage is a combination of photographs and tweets. A tweet, sadly realizing the world is too evil for Mitt to be president. It's sad when you live in a world where someone can be too good. Because, of course, that implies that Barack Obama is just evil enough. Well, last night I have to say I broke down and cried. Did I do so because I was upset that my candidate didn't get elected? Did I do it because the man that deserves to be president more than anyone else we know was denied last night? No. I wept for the country last night. It goes to show how America hasn't just walked away from its values, you know, because that's what happens when you re-elect a man president whose skin is slightly darker than a grocery bag. Hasn't just walked away from its values. We've turned our back on them, and it's a damn shame. This is not a prosperous country anymore. Yeah, because it always was up until the other. It was a prosperous country. It was such a prosperous country. There were no recessions under Bush the Elder and that greasy-headed old walking advertisement for Grecian formula, Ronald Reagan. Oh no, morning in America, by God! There was no runaway inflation during the presidency of Gerald Ford. Oh hell no, there was no Great Depression either. And Republicans during the 1920s didn't cause the Great Depression. No. This is not a kind of prosperous country anymore. It's a place where freedom and glory has come to die. You all voted in a man who is against everything America was built on. Oddly enough, that man was, well, he's the very embodiment of the American dream. Of that notion that anybody has a chance to be president of the United States, because if at the time he was born, and he's just a couple of years older than I, if at the time he was born, anybody had been placing odds on the little mixed race baby lying in the cradle in Honolulu becoming president of the United States, I'd say you'd have better odds than or worse odds than you get buying a Powerball ticket. You all voted in a man who was against everything America was built on. I, for the first time in my life, I'm shamed. And it's because I have to call this man my president. Hope you're happy. We don't have a commander-in-chief. We re-elected a commander in grief.
Oh, the drama.
Young Republicans drown sorrows with alcohol. Oh, you know, all these huddled up white folks, eyes closed, every head bowed, every eye closed. I love this story. Chick-fil-A opening gives disappointed Republicans something to celebrate. What better place for beleaguered Mitt Romney fans and other gay-hating folks to wallow in their post-election sorrows than a brand spanking new Chick-fil-A? Dozens of chicken lovers or gay marriage haters gathered outside the new Walnut Creek Chicken Restaurant yesterday to celebrate the opening of the East Bay location. Hang in there, America. Fight for what's right. Don't look to government or any politician to solve your problems. Government can't make you happy, healthy, wealthy, or wise. Obama is a master at reading the right soaring words fed into his teleprompter. But actions speak louder than words. So hold tight to 2 Corinthians 4:8, because we're in for a wild ride. I didn't know 2 Corinthians 4:8 was talking about wild rides. I've read 2 Corinthians 4:8. We must survive united, one nation under God. 2 Corinthians 4:8 and 9. We are hard-pressed on every side, yet not crushed. We are perplexed, but not in despair. Persecuted, but not forsaken. Struck down, but not destroyed. Signed, Sarah Palin. Yeah, no kidding. Welcome to socialist America. Yay, no social security for our generation, even though we pay taxes for it. I'm going to sign up for food stamps and buy $20 boxes of caviar from Whole Foods and use my unemployment to go buy a BMW tomorrow. And then, like I said, there's a certain story out of West by God. It's the story of a McDonald's. In particular, the McDonald's in Follansbee, West Virginia. That's the toward the northern panhandle of the state. Just across the river from Ohio. You know how it is at McDonald's. Folks show up there in the morning. A lot of senior citizens sit around, have their McMuffins, and whatnot. They're senior size coffees. McDonald's is a pretty busy place in the mornings, especially in a place like Follansbee. Well, the morning after the election, somehow or another, it turned out that the McDonald's of Follansbee, West Virginia, according to WSAZ News Channel 3, yeah, they got an American flag out front of every McDonald's because everybody wants, you know, you want to make sure when you're pulling into a McDonald's that it's not some sort of communist McDonald's or maybe a French McDonald's or maybe a German McDonald's or a Japanese McDonald's. You want to make sure it's an American McDonald's you're pulling into. That's why they got a flag out front. From WSAZ's Facebook, a McDonald's in Follansbee, West Virginia, flew the American flag upside down at half-mast on the morning after the election. Half-staff, I'm sorry. This picture is courtesy NBC affiliate WTOV. What do you think? What do you think? Upside down is a sign of dire distress, right? And half-mast, half-staff, is a universally recognized, at least in this country, I don't know about others, universally recognized symbol of mourning. You only do it when somebody dies. So there on Wednesday, the 7th of November, the flag flew at half staff upside down. I don't think you... Now, I don't have my little handy American Legion book of flag etiquette right here in front of me. But I'm pretty sure you can do one or the other, but not both. Because to fly the flag at half staff indicates somebody's dead. Well, you get the idea. It goes on and on and on. Half staff. America's dead. And I've seen that more and more and more lately. White folks saying, well, I'm going to go get on food stamps. As if you can just go and, I'll take some food stamps, please. As if there's no financial guidelines, as if there's no... No. If nothing else, between the riots at Ole Miss, the stomping of a young man at Ohio State, a freaking McDonald's flying the flag half-staff upside down... All of those gooberish statements I read you a moment ago, can we acknowledge that that part was not settled by the election? That maybe matters are worse now than they were? But if we were to be optimistic, might we also note that these are the barbaric, fading yawps of a species that knows it is endangered and isn't coming back? I'm anxious to see a map, a more detailed county map of what's red and what's blue, especially in the South. Because you know what? If, I don't know, Fayette County, Alabama is just blood red, that doesn't That doesn't even, you know, red, damn it. But what happens when, say, Birmingham is blue? Well, the whole of that little itty bitty pissant county cannot make up a couple or three precincts in Birmingham, if in fact Birmingham is blue. There were, to the best of my knowledge, only a few states in this country that went exclusively Romlicious. Romnalicious. As of the vote tally of Tuesday night into Wednesday, the reddest county in America is, I believe, anybody surprised? Utah. Every county in Utah went for Bishop Willard Romney. Every county in Oklahoma went for Bishop Willard Romney. Every county in West Virginia went for Bishop Willard Romney. But you can't say the same for every county in Texas. You cannot say the same, I don't think, for every county in Mississippi. Or Alabama, or Tennessee. Maybe you can, but I'm guessing no. Wouldn't it be great if we had a 50-state strategy that would identify and nurture potential candidates in those red states and begin a conversation, begin a dialogue? Oh, very funny, Irish Dave. So any congressional district that Chicken Mitt won would be a C.D. Romney? Congressional district. That's pretty awful. I've got an article here from Truth Out by Eleanor J. Bader. Starts out telling the story of Merrill Johnson, a Cleveland, Ohio high school English teacher. She says that she spends about $400 to $500 a year on supplies for her students in the classroom. She says, I have a pretty extensive classroom library because of all the books I've bought over the 41 years I've been teaching. At times I've bought sets, 35 or 40 copies of one text for my students. Why? Because there's so much red tape to go through if you ask the district to buy them. If you go through the school system's channels, by the time the book gets approved and are ordered, the school year's over. This, she says, has been a long-standing problem. Back in 2010, the National School Supply and Equipment Association found that 92% of teachers spend their own money on supplies and 85% buy instructional materials for the people they teach. The conclusion the report reached was as follows. Teachers' personal money is the most common source of funding for classroom projects. On average, teachers spent a total of $398 on school supplies in 2009-2010 and an additional $538 on educational materials. The total, write this down. The next time you hear some right-wing, godforsaken, good-for-nothing repig-licking talking about how the money gets wasted in our government schools, the total expended that year, 2009 to 2010, by the nation's 3.7 million teachers comes to $3.5 billion. And in that number lies the seeds of another national dialogue that needs to take place. Jim and I talked considerable length last night about the Pentagon budget. I brought it up because in all of this grand bargain BS and over-the-cliff BS, lordy, don't the for-profit media love themselves something they can crank out on the Chiron. Over the cliff! Yeah, because, you know, we're all Thelma and Louise, right? But in talking about things like that, we never talk. It is illegal, I think, or somehow anti-dogmatic or anti-orthodox to talk about the Pentagon's budget. The Pentagon's budget doesn't need to be cut as a result of some sort of drop-dead date ginned up between the Congress and the President. The Pentagon's budget needs to be cut because schools ought not be needing a $3.5 billion infusion of voluntary taxation from its own teachers. Now, $3.5 billion is a lot of money, no matter how you count it or in what denomination. But it's chicken feed to the Pentagon. Shucks, that's just a little handful of Tommy Hawk missiles. Right? Summer 2012 issue of NEA Today, that's the National Education Association, 66% of education support workers. That's bus drivers, custodians, lunchroom staff, secretaries, security guards, skilled tradespeople. They kick in an extra $216 per employee per year. They're doing that because the school budgets themselves have had a razor blade taken to them. They have been slashed. The slashers? Repiglickens. Because Repiglickens don't believe in education. At least not the public kind. Repiglickens are fine with education if it's being done by some religious hoodoo salesman. But we won't be teaching no science and no evolution, none of that. There are 98,800 public elementary and secondary schools in the United States. 49.8 million kids attend them. According to Education Week, every state has its own formula for providing a level of funding necessary for a basic education. The amount of money particular school districts receive tends to vary dramatically, depending largely on property values, not just from state to state, but from district to district and year to year. And that in itself is ancient and barbaric. And it takes various forms. Down south, you've got, and elsewhere, but you've got city school systems inside counties that have separate county school systems. So that you've got a fundamentally unequal funding process there and an unequal system. Dr. John asked a question earlier this evening about suddenly kids rioting in favor of the status of you know, things like white privilege. Well, that probably happens. Look, kids hear the radio when mom and dad are driving down the road listening to Flush Flemball. Kids hear and see the TV when mommy and daddy turn on Bill O'Reilly or that life support system for a haircut, the pinhead Sean Hannity. they hear Neil Bortz when he says, government schools. Are we surprised then? Are we surprised? When they go to failing schools where teachers themselves and support personnel have to prop it up? There are lots of discussions that need to happen in this country that could very easily be happening if we weren't obsessed with talking about endlessly election processes. Like I said at the beginning of the program, today I saw a little package filed by some member of the professional for-profit media on one of these cable channels about who we can expect to run in 2016. Really? Could we not have used that minute and 28 seconds for a report on what austerity has done to Greece? The rise of fascism in Greece. You know, the rise of fascism anywhere in the world should be cause for concern. Should be. But then again, we've got the rise of fascism going on here, and we get articles, we get packages on cable news channels about who's going to run for president. It's got to be Hillary. Jesus, that masturbation fest is beginning. Will Hillary run? When will Hillary? Why hasn't she already declared? Hillary. Oh, and there it was, a photograph of Hillary next to a photograph of Jebby. The for-profit media have already telegraphed who they hope will be the contest in 2016. Just can't quite get off that Bush-Clinton bandwagon. Because they know it'll always be entertaining. It's disgusting. But let's not talk about hunger. Let's not talk about education. Let's not talk about foreign policy or war policy. Let's talk about who's going to be in the next horse race. Jesus, it's like this entire country lives at Santa Anita or Aqueduct. And all we do is spend our time handicapping the next race. And I'm frustrated. Now we can try to do something about it here. We can try to shoehorn those stories into among the stuff that the shiny, sparkly, election-y things that so easily grab our attention. I know if Kate had her way, we wouldn't mention another political story for the rest of the life of the horn. And she's got a mighty good point. Andy writing in, fascism rising. Clearly, it's here. Yeah. It is. Pretty good sign of it when the little white kids at the University of Mississippi decide to riot over the election of that one going back to our White House. Let's go to the phones. 304-658-3333 is the number. Hey, welcome to the program. Hello?
Hey. Hey, this is Kevin.
Hey, Kevin, what's up? I got you.
Hey, sorry about that. I had you on speaker. Hey, you know, I was sitting here listening to you talk about that, and the thought occurred to me, this is the few trying to impose the will, their will, on those of us in the majority, because we were in the majority. Obama got more votes, you know, but...
Oh, no, but that doesn't slow him down, because I've seen the stuff out there, Kevin said, what a tragedy. Mitt Romney won the popular vote but lost the Electoral College. No, he didn't.
That's because Carl Rove was pushing that Fox News the other night.
Right.
And Carl, he was winning the popular vote until the Western states came in, but the election was another one of them winning the popular vote, you know?
Yeah, and but your Fox viewers, they've got an early bedtime.
Oh, yeah, I know. Tell me about it. We've talked about that before, but I just, you know, thinking about it on the other side, what if that had been us that had lost the election?
Well, I know what we'd be saying.
Well, yeah, I know what we'd be saying, too. And
we'd be saying that it was stolen, just like in 2000 and 2004, and the other side would scream, get over it!
Yep, exactly. And that's what we need to be telling them.
Well, no, I think our response is okay. We're not yelling, get over it.
Yep.
We're just, well, I think we get to kind of ignore them.
Yeah, exactly. That's probably the best way to do it. But if I go out tomorrow, I'm taking my campaign button and wearing it.
Oh, yeah.
Get me hurt, but I'm pissed. I am not taking this.
Oh, I've got a magnificent hat here that was sent to me, by Bruce out in Wisconsin. And it's got an anatomically correct kicking donkey on it. And
okay.
I'm wearing it proudly. And it says Democrats.
Yep.
The only problem is that word does not mean the same thing around here that it means in the rest of the country.
Well, it can't when you keep electing Joe Manchin to the Senate. Or Blanche Manchin, whatever. Whoever.
Do you realize what he would have done if it had been a 50-50 split in the Senate and Romney had been elected? He would have been a Republican so fast that it would have made his hair fly out of place.
Yep.
Because he would have been promised the world and all its dominions.
Yep. And that should be one on if you want to say it that way, but that should be on the target list for 2014. Not only the Republican seats in Congress, but those so-called blue dog Democrats who aren't really Democrats, and I've got a few names I can't repeat, Democrat, you know, that I want to call them instead of blue dog. But we need to try them. And like you were saying about the 50-state strategy, that was one of my worries going into this election, is because Obama didn't apply that 50-state strategy, that he might have made a mistake in doing that. And I'm all for, you know, I want the president to call Howard Dean and say, could you come back on and do this? I don't think you will, but I want him to, because that's what we need. When you got it, what was it, 100,000 vote difference in Mississippi?
Yeah.
Between Romney? So you're making gains in the South. You just can't see them yet because it's still, the majority's still red. But when it's only $100,000...
Well, and because they're still managing to suppress the vote.
Yes.
I mean, understand that there were massive voter suppression efforts all over this country, especially in the Confederacy, Kevin. And they didn't work. They didn't work in Florida. They didn't work in Pennsylvania. They didn't work in Ohio.
The only reason they didn't work, though, Bob, this was not, as was the election in 08, this was not a normal election. This was an election where Obama's people begged people to get out and vote. I saw it on the sub-precinct level. They were getting out the vote like I have never seen before. But a normal election, this wouldn't have happened. And we would be screaming it was stolen. That's the only reason it wasn't, is we simply overwhelmed them. And we put out people to vote in record numbers. And when people are in line, hey, I got to give it to the people down there in Florida. When you're in line 4 hours to cast your vote and you stay there to vote.
Yeah, see, that's patriotism.
Exactly. That's true patriotism. You don't have to beat your chest and say I'm a patriot. You prove it.
Now, oddly enough, Kevin, and I'm saying this out of ignorance and not out of any specific knowledge, those stories about six-hour waits are largely coming from South Florida.
Yep.
Where are the stories of six-hour waits in those red counties of Florida? Do they even exist?
No. But, see, this is what's interesting to me. I'm from Tampa, from the Tampa area. They went blue.
Yeah.
And they were not expected to go blue. So, you know, now there were no long lines up there, except in those normal parts of the Bay Area that normally would vote Democratic. But as far as the counties themselves, no, they didn't expect Tampa and St. Pete to go blue. They really didn't. And so,
That's because they had it on good authority from Rick Scott that he had a bunch of that Latino vote and that the blah vote. They had that taken care of.
Yep. It's going to be an interesting ride the next 4 years, and I'm not sure I really want to see it all, but, you know, you're going to be forced to see it anyway because these people are crazy. They're just, they're brainwashed.
But I love it. I love it that the teabaggers are out there saying, well, we didn't teabag enough. And the anti-abortion freaks are out there saying, well, we didn't talk enough about abortion. And you know what? Do that. Please do that some more. Because America is sick to death of this. I mean, I never knew if I would see the day, but I'm beginning to wonder if we are seeing the dawning of the day in which America really, really, really is, Kevin, sick and damn tired of all of this culture war BS.
Yep. I think so, but then I'm sort of leaning that way, you know, but when it's only 100,000 vote difference in Mississippi, Stan, then I think you got a good case for it. I think there's a very good case to be said for it. And, you know, the reddest county in the country was in Utah, you said?
No, the reddest state in the country.
State in the country. But there was only, what was it, two or three states that went totally, every county went.
I don't know what that exact number is, but I know Utah did, I know Oklahoma did, and I know West Virginia did.
Yep. And here in Colorado, we didn't, obviously, but down here in southern Colorado, we didn't. We did go, you know, the county I'm in did go for Romney, but only by a 60-40 margin, and that's the target number for us. If we can pull out 40% of the Democrats to vote for the Democrat, he's winning the state. And, you know, that's what we were shooting for. They made it sound like it was something bad that we only got 40%. We're thrilled with 40%. So, you know, I think there's a good case for it. I think there will be, once we get the political stuff out of the way, I think you will start seeing some backlash of people against the church. I think that's what happened Tuesday night, too. When you tell me that my soul is in jeopardy if I vote for Obama, I guarantee a lot of people went out and said, I'm going to vote for Obama. The heck with you. And nobody knows how they voted because they vote in secrecy. So you can tell your parish priest all you want that you voted.
Well, you know, considering the things that they preach, they lie to their parishioners day in and day out every time the doors open. So I guess it, can we say that there's a sliding scale involved somewhere here, Kevin?
Probably. But I just, you know, I just wanted to comment on that, Bob. I know you got other people, and I just wanted to comment on that one thing because I think we've got to realize these poor people down in Mississippi who rioted, they don't know no better, and they're now very much in the minority. So we ignore them. Like I said, just ignore them. They'll eventually go away because, except for Glenn Beck, and I keep wondering when one day somebody's gonna come drag him off the set.
One of these days he's just gonna he'll be on screen when he sticks the business end of a revolver in his mouth and just takes care of business.
It's
got a family history of it.
Well, if you listened to him the other night, Bob, I think you played one of the clips. If you listened to him, he was crying at one point.
Oh, yes, he was.
You know? So what does that tell you? And they're obsessed. It's an obsession with him now. He can't be wrong. He can't possibly be wrong. And one day, in one of those little quiet little moments, he's going to allow himself to finally think, and maybe you're right. You know, I don't wish suicide on anybody, but I do fear for the man in that regard because I've seen it before. And wouldn't surprise me. It can happen to any of us. And if you get in the right emotional state, you know, unfortunately that's something that happens. And with a history of it on top of it. So, you know. But I just don't want the, you know, the dog whistles and that for people to get out and do something. That's what I don't want to see. I would hope now that we're firmly entrenched with a Democratic administration that maybe we can get some things changed with the FCC. And one of those things is when somebody like Beck or Limbaugh is on air encouraging people to do violence, that they're fined, sanctioned, taken off the air by the FCC.
Well, but no, you can't do anything to Beck because he's down to operating on the internet like we do. Okay? The FCC has no jurisdiction over content on the internet.
Right.
But there does need to be there needs to be some consideration, and this is a larger consideration than simply broadcast, of what constitutes incitement. At what point in time can we draw a bright line, or can we at least note that the bright line exists when right-wing gas bag A says go shoot C and intermediary B does their bidding?
Yep. Well, I wondered after George Stewart got killed how come I think it was Hannity that had it actually incited that one.
And oh, no, Tiller? No, Dr. Tiller?
Yeah.
No, that was Bill O'Reilly's work primarily,
O'Reilly,
because he was the
right
one that was constantly calling him Tiller the Killer.
Yeah. But he had said something on air just before Tiller got killed about kind of wishing someone would go shoot the guy or something like that. And I'm wondering why he didn't get a knock on his door. We need you to come down and answer a few questions, because isn't that the definition of incitement? To do and say that, and then hope for it to happen.
Well, the traditional thinking has always been that you can't hold a broadcaster liable for that because, well, I mean, there's all kinds of crazy people all over, and nobody really wants anybody to do anything like that. I mean, this is, for instance, you know, when you catch the Flush Flimball doing something like that. He'll, my friends, I am only a comedian. I'm just an entertainer. This is an entertainment program. This is not a news program, and it is certainly not to be taken seriously.
Yep.
And that's what those are the skirts that they hide behind.
but they were on the same skirts that I would be allowed to hide behind. If I said that, if I said that to a group of people and somebody in that group went out and did that, they'd be knocking at my door.
Well, but that fails to take into account, Kevin, the most important factor in all of this, IOKIYAR. It's okay if you're a Republican.
Right. Exactly. That's pretty much it. What else can you say?
But they know what they're doing. You know, God, I love that nickname. When Princess Dumbass of the Northwoods, Sarah Palin, tweets out a line from 2 Corinthians that says, "We are hard pressed, we are persecuted, we are down but not defeated." Well, you know, that means you need to go do something.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, as I showed you by that letter the other night, that's pretty much the line they're all taking.
Yeah.
And that worries me just simply, you know. I got to say they're brainwashed. I can't put it any other way.
I know.
I'm for anybody celebrating whatever faith they want to do, but what's the difference between the Taliban and the Taliban of the West here in America? There is no difference. When you're encouraging violence, whether it's the Taliban of the East or the Taliban of the West, it needs to be stopped. And I don't know.
And well, no, you've got a good handle on it, Kevin. They are a Christian fundamentalist version of the Taliban. And frankly, if you pin some of them down, you don't even have to get them liquored up to get them to admit it. Organ outfits like the Christian Reconstructionists, they'll tell you they want to return to biblical law and they want to start stoning people yesterday.
Yep.
I remember when the leader of that bunch was asked why stoning, he said, because there's a lot of rocks.
Yep.
Wow. You know, just wow. Kevin, have yourself a good night, my friend.
Thank you, Bob.
Take it easy.
Bye.
Bye now. Kevin, calling from Colorado Springs. Onward. Hey, welcome to the program.
Good evening.
Hey, Jim, what's happening?
I would like to compliment you on having your guest earlier in the program on there.
Oh, Paul, yes.
Absolutely. He was extremely informative and the whole thing behind what he's fighting is absolutely mind-boggling as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I mean, you live in it.
Yeah.
You know, just because you're not right smack dab under the mountain doesn't mean you're not breathing it.
Well,
because, you know, we're talking about particles that are less than 10 microns in size that look under a microscope like jagged shards of glass, not to mention all the poisons, the hydrocarbon poisons, the polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. You breathe it. So does everybody who lives downwind of it.
Well,
it's sobering, to say the least.
It is indeed. Absolutely. And as far as these people going away, they're not going to go away.
No. They're going to have to be caught, picked up by the dustbin of history.
Well, perhaps so. Perhaps so. But I mean, they can preach all the hate and foment all the types of rebellion and generate all the types of violence they want to. But who's to say whether or not they themselves might be destroyed by their own hatred and violence? You know, when bullets start flying and things start happening, well, it depends on which direction they're going and who fired them. That thing at Ole Miss, I wasn't surprised at Ole Miss. My God in heaven. Ole Miss is still back in the 50s.
Well, this is the 50th anniversary of the violent integration of that institution of so-called higher learning.
Well, yeah, you know, and you know, one of my favorite writers, whom I've talked about a lot on this program, Florence King, graduated from Ole Miss, and she.
Yeah, let's not make the mistake of thinking that it's a poor institution because of the poor behavior, but it is certainly an institution that is a product of its environs.
And she points, and she in her books, Confessions of a Failed Southern Woman and Southern Ladies and Gentlemen, she talks or writes extensively about Ole Miss and the types of thought that exists there. And it really hasn't changed as an institution, in my opinion. It may have changed superficially, but deep down, it hadn't changed a bit.
Well, but one of the problems, Jim, is that there is a myth being perpetuated that there has been no change whatsoever, when in fact we know that there has been. Like I said, if you drill down into a map of these so-called red states, you know, you'll find that yeah, there's been an abundance of change, because look at a voting map, for instance, of Georgia, and look at Atlanta. There ain't nothing red about Atlanta.
Well, Bob, Atlanta is not a southern town. Never has been, never will be.
But you can say the same thing about Nashville. You can say the same thing about Birmingham. You can say the same thing about New Orleans.
Atlanta is not southern. It is not a typical southern town. And the reason that these towns have not changed or have changed and have become more enlightened is because of the presence of federal agencies and other things that have been located there. Atlanta is like the nerve center of the entire Southeast. We're talking about as far as government, business, that and the other thing. Atlanta is the New York of the South.
Well, it very much is, but there's more to it than that. You talk about the federal influence, the influence of federal actions to preserve voting rights is another huge part of it. That's why the right wing in the South has to constantly be gerrymandering and redistricting its voting strategy so as to make sure that they keep there from being any real democracy. Because they always wind up gerrymandering them, Jim, to make sure that all the persons of color go in one district. And that's fact. Think about the Texas redistricting job of a few years ago, where you had a gerrymandered district that stretched from, what, Austin to San Antonio or something, and was 1 mile wide between a 1 mile wide strip between them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they just had to do that because that's the way it all shook out. Voter suppression is something that takes place every day in Republican land. They cannot stand the idea of the franchise being exercised by, you know, the wrong people. They know that they cannot win unless they cheat. They cannot win. They cannot win on a level playing field. They must tilt the board in their favor.
Well, they can try, and they can.
Well, they're about as far into their success as they're ever going to get.
Well, that's what I'm trying to say. If you know, they can only redistrict and redraw and gerrymander so many times until they're gerrymandered out.
Well, they're running out of ways to provide white dominance inside voting districts, and that is why, for instance, in one of these meaningless puff pieces that ran on cable news somewhere. That's why every time the question is asked, well, who in God's name will the Republicans run in 2016? It's immediately a litany of those hardcore right-wingers who happen to have Hispanic-sounding names, whether it be Cruz in Texas or Rubio in Florida. because it's a very cynical calculation, Jim. They think, well, yeah, we just need somebody that looks right.
Well, did they have somebody who looked right this time?
Well, it looked right to white.
Well,
but there are members of the party, Jeb Bush among them, who are saying, you know, we've got a real Latino problem. They can't quite bring themselves to say that we've got an African American problem, because every time they, you know, you get an Alan West out there, well, see, we've got a black person in the Republican Party, and he turns out to be the most hateful, miserable, sorry, right-wing fascist, you know, whether it's him or Clarence Thomas. You know, look, I mean, why won't black people like us?
Well, I think they've begun to scratch their heads and think about that and realize that no longer are white males going to bring them victory in any type of election. I think this has been a shot across their bow. And I hope it's going to cause them to rethink.
Oh, they won the angry white male vote by going away, Jim. But it cannot defeat the Latino vote, the African American vote, and the female vote, and the youth vote.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. And I think you said earlier about being swept into the dust of history. I mean, these people have had their day. They sit on their stages. They promulgated their doctrines of hate, and they tried to suppress voter action. But I think they are basically going to be overwhelmed by the diversity of the population of this country.
They know they are. They have seen the moving hand right upon the wall, Jim.
I understand that, Bob. What I'm trying to say is, I think that even when I looked at Fox News the other night, that they began to look at themselves and rethink, well, what have we done wrong? What happened?
And what I love, Jim, is the fact that the answer being given is, you didn't focus on abortion enough. You didn't hate the gays enough. I love these groups, that they did not have enough hate.
Well, I'm sorry. Hate is not a commodity that you can eat. Hate destroys those who hate.
No, but I want them to buy into that philosophy. I really, really do.
Well, I don't think you have any problem there, because they bought well into it. And so if they die, they're going to engender, these seeds of hate. But I would hope, from all my heart, that the younger generation is seeing this isn't the way to go.
Well, consider that first-time voters, 18-year-olds in 2016, will have known for two-thirds of their life, they will have known a president with dark skin.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You're the one who noted that there are some things only the grave can cure. And maybe we're seeing that curing taking place.
Well, let's hope that there will be change, and they will realize that no one is wearing them this year, as I said two nights ago, and they're going to have to try some type of new tactic.
Indeed.
You know, what are they going to do? Are they going to start their own brown shirt party?
They already did that. They're called teabaggers.
Exactly. What I was referring to, because the teabaggers are the brown shirts. They are the SA.
Very much so. Hey, Jim, I got to get out of here. We're up against it, but it's awful good to hear from you tonight.
Oh, it is late. I'm sorry.
No worries. We'll talk soon.
Yeah.
All right. Bye now. And so we come to the end of the program. A note from Kate. She says, in my defense, lest I come off sounding like a disinterested fill-in-the-blank, I'm more apt to want to discuss solutions rather than focusing incessantly on the problems. Yes, we're a mess socially, culturally, physically, and emotionally. In all those areas, we're bankrupt. It is my contention that repeating the woes, we magnify them. We would be better served if we started concentrating on the solutions. And I agree. the only point being that you have to accurately identify the problems before you can start talking about solutions. Antifungal cream does not work on a sucking chest wound. Kate says, my socialist Democrat self is rearing her head. Time to step away from the keyboard for now. To be continued. P.S., says Kate, how much more do we need tonight to match the challenge? $10. $10. So thanks go out to all of you who keep all of this going with your contributions and your ideas. Both of them fuel this conversation, this dialogue. Thank you to our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky in the chat room. Thanks to our blogger, Texas Betsy. Thanks to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thanks, Agnes. Thanks, John Fox. We heard from Ben Birch tonight. Thanks, Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and AICACT.org. Go there, get involved with passing the AIC Act, and let's see, speaking of solutions, if we can't fix the mess that has been made, the horror that has been created in Appalachia. AICACT.org. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you. Hey, here comes Rick Smith on the horn.